Good evening. It is 7 o'clock daylight saving time in the Midwest, and this is KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week for Monday, March 15th. I'm Dennis Hart. Welcome to another in our series of live programs in this time slot that will explore and analyze what's going on at Iowa's state capitol, legislation that's in the works, legislation that could be in the works, and what it all means for all of us. As always, I'm joined by Laura Belland of the must-read political blog site Bleeding Heartland. Good evening, Laura. It is always a pleasure to be with you on these Monday nights.
Nice to speak with you, Dennis.
And nice to see you via Zoom. Well, lots of things went on as usual in the state legislature last week, Laura, but let's begin with the legal action that took place involving the voting changes bill that Governor Reynolds signed into law 1 week ago tonight. Now, we all know that law puts new restrictions on such things as early voting, absentee voting, even on the time that polls are going to be open on election day. But what happened, Laura, after we went off the air last Monday night? What happened on the legal front?
Well, first thing Tuesday morning, the first lawsuit was filed challenging that law. And it was the Democratic lawyer Mark Elias, who's been involved in dozens of lawsuits around the country. And he is the lead attorney for LULAC. That's the League of United Latin American Citizens of Iowa. They're the plaintiffs. I imagine I wouldn't be surprised to see other plaintiffs join this case, but they obviously they had it ready to go and they were just waiting for the governor to sign that bill.
What's their basis of the lawsuit?
Well, there are four counts that they're claiming. And one thing that's important is they're suing in state court and they're making claims under the Iowa Constitution, not the U.S. Constitution. And the main reason for that is that Iowa's Constitution does expressly protect the right to vote. The U.S. Constitution, a lot of people don't realize this, it doesn't anywhere guarantee the right to vote, but the state constitution does. So that's the main, the first count is that all of these various restrictions that we've talked about the last few weeks, the limitations on early voting, the limitations on who can hand deliver your ballot, the new limitations on how the satellite voting and the shorter time to vote on election day, that all of those things will infringe on the right to vote for Iowans. And then there's the second and the third count. This was interesting. I hadn't thought about this, but free speech and free assembly. They're claiming that the limits on hand delivering ballots violate the LULAC, which is an advocacy group for Latinos, that normally they do a lot of voter advocacy and they would help people return their ballots. So that might be something what some people would call a ballot chase program, where they contact people who have requested a ballot, haven't returned it yet, and help those people get those ballots turned in on time. So they're saying that this law will restrict LULAC's ability to do core political expression in the form of helping people to vote and also helping people assemble together for the common good. So they're claiming that that's constitutionally protected conduct. And then the fourth count is an equal protection count. And I think we talked about this. This is the idea that most voters will have to have their absentee ballots in by 8 p.m. on election day. Otherwise, they won't be counted. But some voters, namely people in the military, people living overseas, and a small number of people of domestic violence survivors in something called the Safe at Home program. Those people can mail their ballots, and if they arrive after election day, they can still be counted if they had a postmark. So they're saying that that's not treating all voters the same because if you're in another state where you spend the winters and you mail your ballot in and it arrives the day after the election, even though you mailed it much earlier, your ballot wouldn't be counted. But somebody living in Toronto, their ballot would be counted under the same circumstances. So that's an equal protection claim. And that was something that a lot of people predicted would be challenged.
Based on your reporting and the people you've talked to, what are the odds that you perceive of the success of this lawsuit?
I think it's going to be a heavy lift, and that this Iowa Supreme Court is very conservative and tends to be deferential to what the legislature does. I think if there's one area of the law that is vulnerable, it's this limit on who can hand deliver your ballot, because that really is quite restrictive. If you're a person with disabilities living alone, so you don't have a household member and you don't have a formal caretaker, and yet you can't leave your house to drive and go somewhere to a drop box, that's going to be pretty difficult. So you can't ask a friend or a neighbor or a colleague, so someone you know from church. I mean, I feel that that's possible that that could be struck down. I think many of the other limitations, although they do restrict people's ability to get their absentee ballots and get those counted, it's not so far outside the norm. I mean, the poll opening hours, they're going from 14 hours on election day to 13 hours. That's still well within the national average. The 20 days to mail ballots, that's shorter than the national average, but it's probably not so short, I think, that this court would overturn it. So there's actually going to be another lawsuit filed at some point by the Libertarian Party. They're going to be challenging a different part of the law that vastly increases the number of signatures third-party candidates need to collect to qualify for the ballot. And I talked to a couple of people in the election law world, and they think that the Libertarians have a decent chance of getting that struck down, although probably it wouldn't happen before the next election cycle. So that, and that's not really the core of the law that affects how hundreds of thousands of people will vote.
As you and I have talked, Republicans in dozens of states, I believe 43 in the last count, have gone after voter laws, trying to restrict voting. They say it's a way to increase confidence in elections, though there is absolutely no evidence, of course, of any fraud involving the presidential election in which Joe Biden defeated Donald Trump. So what happened in Iowa is happening in other states with legislatures attempting the same thing.
Yes, and that's, I mean, an argument that comes up again and again in the plaintiff's court filing is that there is no legitimate government interest at all. I mean, not only is there not a compelling interest in these limitations, but there's just no legitimate interest because there's absolutely no evidence of any problems related to satellite voting, voting by mail, people hand delivering ballots, and all of these other things that are going to be more restrictive. I think that a big issue that the Iowa Supreme Court will eventually need to decide here is what standard do they apply to these. So in cases where government laws or executive orders are being challenged, if it's something that limits a fundamental constitutional right, a court will subject that to a very high level of scrutiny called strict scrutiny. But typically, limits on early voting have not been subjected to strict scrutiny because the idea is you still have the option to vote on election day. And there's a lot of precedent that says that states have a lot of authority to limit absentee ballots in a way that might be more suspect if they were limiting election day voting. So I think that if the court uses a lower standard, what's called a rational basis standard, then the state only would have to prove that they have some legitimate interest. And what the plaintiffs were, they were trying to preempt this argument by saying there's not even any legitimate interest. I mean, there's just nothing, and there's nothing in the legislative debate. They were talking about things like shortening political campaigns. And of course, these shortening the period that people can return an absentee ballot doesn't do anything to shorten political campaigns because candidates will be out there knocking on doors and making phone calls and running radio and TV ads months ahead of time, just as usual.
We will be following this on Capitol Week, and it's going to make big news, pardon me, down the road here. Remember that time you had a frog in your throat? I think that frog's in my throat now. It is 7 minutes after the hour of 7 o'clock. This is Capitol Week. I'm Dennis Hart with the frog, and that's Laura Bellin of the Bleeding Heartland website. Let's talk about what happened last week in the state Senate. The Senate passed two bills involving the police. One has to do with efforts that cities might make to defund the police. Now, the Senate acted on this, and 10 Democratic Party senators joined Republican senators to vote in favor. Unpack that one for us, if you would.
I mean, it was an interesting debate and an interesting vote. I mean, basically, none of the Democrats really supported this bill. Nobody spoke in favor of the bill. And the Democrats proposed several amendments that Republicans rejected. And yet, I think that the Senate Minority Leader Zach Walls even admitted the next day in a press availability that really it wasn't that his caucus was divided on the core issue, but it was that people were worried that this bill was going to be setting things up for an attack ad that, you know, you didn't oppose defunding the police. So it was really more of a protect themselves vote. But the bill, I mean, what's interesting about the bill is that no one's proposing to defund the police anywhere in Iowa. There aren't any city councils. There aren't any mayors trying to do that. And it would really limit the local authority. They made some adjustments to it. And there were some critics saying, look, you know, if a police department buys a new vehicle 1 year and then the next year they don't need to buy a new vehicle, so their budget would go down, you know, under this original draft of this bill, they would lose all their state funding because of that. So they changed it a little bit. So now, you know, they can still make a cut if there was a one-time spending on vehicles or equipment, if they were also, if senior staff retired and then they hired incoming officers at a lower salary, that would be allowed. If they merged or consolidated services, that would be allowed. And if the city or the county or the jurisdiction had a decline in population, that would be allowed. But for all other reasons, they wouldn't be able to reduce their police budget. And that would be a big problem. And several people, actually, the senator from Ames, Herman Kornbach, who used to serve on the Ames City Council, probably some of your listeners remember his time on the city council. He was recalling some innovative things they did with law enforcement. And he said this kind of a law would really limit the local government, what they could do in terms of pilot projects or trying out hiring a new resource officer. Because if it doesn't pan out, you're locked into that spending forever because you can't cut that spending the next year. Otherwise, you'd lose all your state funding. So he said, you know, this really isn't going to achieve what you're trying to do. And one of the amendments that I thought was kind of funny was there's a debate going on over traffic cameras separately. A separate bill that the Senate approved would ban traffic cameras. And those are in use in Cedar Rapids and Des Moines, and they provide quite a bit of revenue for the local police department. So the Senator Nate Bolton from Des Moines, he had an amendment that said that if the legislature does something that deprives a law enforcement agency of a revenue source, then they have to exempt them from this law. Because if the city of Des Moines loses the $2 or $3 million they get in a year from the traffic cameras, I mean, they won't be able to avoid cutting their budget, I think. So, and in any case, this bill, it passed the Senate. It sounded like the House Speaker, Pat Grassley, wasn't too interested in moving this forward. So I'm going to still keep an eye on it. But I don't really think that that's going to reach the governor's desk.
At the same time, the Senate passed that one. They passed another bill involving police, giving them qualified immunity against lawsuits and allowing officers to get more information in complaint investigations. Could you download that one?
Yes, a qualified immunity is a topic that I really didn't know anything about until a few years ago, but it's being talked about more and more. So the general concept, and it doesn't just apply to police, but it applies to anybody working in government. If you do something in the capacity of your work for the government and you violate someone's rights, you can't be sued personally if you were acting in your official capacity. And it mostly comes up in the context of police because when people experience violations of their rights, it's just more often that those interactions occur when they're with law enforcement. And so qualified immunity was never part of any law, federal or state law. It was a doctrine that the courts developed over a series of decades, and it just has made it harder and harder for people to address issues. I mean, sometimes even fatal shootings by police that were unjustified, police have been found to be not liable because of this qualified immunity, or rather the lawsuits just can't even get off the ground because of this qualified immunity. So the Iowa Supreme Court had a decision in 2018 called the Baldwin decision. This was came up several times during the Senate debate where they kind of set out a qualified immunity doctrine for Iowa that said the police need to show that they exercise due care. That was the standard, that if they exercise due care and a reasonable person would say that that was a reasonable action to take, then you can't sue them in their capacity. And that's a little bit more favorable to the person whose rights have been violated compared to what the U.S. Supreme Court and other federal courts have outlined, which is a standard of that unless it was clearly established that this was a violation of someone's rights, then you can't sue the police. And what's happened in practice, this came up during the debate. For instance, it's been established that if somebody is unarmed and lying on the ground with their arms out, the police can't stick their dog on that person and bite that person. So there was a case where somebody was unarmed, sitting on the ground with his arms raised, and the police unleashed the dog who injured the man. And when he sued the police, the federal court said that this was not clearly established that this was a violation because it was not similar enough to the other case where the person was lying on the ground. So in any case, so the law that the Senate passed adopts this federal standard that if it's not a clearly established law, you really aren't going to be able to sue the police over anything. And the Democrats were trying to get it changed to be more like what the Iowa Supreme Court has said, that the police would have to show that they exercise due care. But that didn't carry the day. I mean, the amendments offered by the minority party almost never pass, and that was the case for this bill as well. So the floor manager was saying this is about protecting police from frivolous lawsuits, and we can't afford to have, when they're making split-second decisions, we can't afford to have them worried that they might be subject to a frivolous lawsuit, which really was a red herring because people don't get to file frivolous lawsuits against the police. I mean, it's hard enough to file a lawsuit even in a situation like what happened to Breonna Taylor in Louisville, where police broke into her home and shot her while she was sleeping. You know, that, I mean, these are the situations that the lawsuits that lead to these qualified immunity rulings are usually really egregious violations of people's rights or bodily integrity.
So it's interesting because while they passed these, well, these are on the way. They've been passed through anyway. They're going to be voted on later, these two bills involving the police. The lawmakers refused to bring forward the governor's proposal to ban racial profiling by police. And one might think, and I wonder if it's fair to think, that the message that lawmakers got, Iowa lawmakers got from last summer's Black Lives Matter protest, is that police must be protected.
Yes, definitely. And even more so with another bill that has been approved by the Senate that increases penalties for various kinds of crimes, like rioting is one of them, and failure to disperse is one of them. And in a couple of cases would make certain crimes, nonviolent crimes, but related to protesting, felonies. And the fiscal note on that bill had what's called a minority impact statement. There, on some bills, they're required to get some expert analysis on how would this affect people of color in Iowa. And the minority impact statements on that bill really said this would vastly increase the number of people of color sentenced because these charges are disproportionately applied to people of color. So definitely, I feel that that's the message that's being sent. I mean, protect the police, but also really bring down the hammer at the people who are protesting police actions. And the governor had this idea of combining a lot of things into one bill that would also ban racial profiling while increasing penalties for some of these crimes and banning cities from defunding the police and so on. But as you said, the Republicans didn't move forward any of the anti-racial profiling. They just moved forward the other provisions. And some of these bills, the police groups, the law enforcement groups aren't even necessarily in favor of some of these concepts. So we'll see whether all of this gets through the House in the same version, but it's a really strong message that the Iowa legislature has no sympathy for the policing reform movement in general.
From police, let's go to money. The Senate Ways and Means Committee, State Senate Ways and Means Committee, last week passed a bill that would result in quicker income tax cuts and the elimination of the inheritance tax in Iowa. Can you talk about that one?
Yes. Well, Iowa already eliminated most of the inheritance tax. So you can't, you're not taxed on anything you pass along to children or grandchildren. That's been a long time ago that's been gone. But of course, some people leave money or property to, perhaps they don't have children, or perhaps they leave things to cousins or nieces or nephews or friends. And those are subject to inheritance tax. So that would be pretty pricey when it's fully phased in. I think the estimate was $90 or $100 million. It's quite a lot. And the triggers that were mentioned, this was part of a big tax cut bill in 2018 that the governor signed the first year she was a governor and the legislature was in session. And they made a big deal at that time of saying that this was fiscally responsible because certain of the tax cuts wouldn't go into effect unless state revenue hit certain targets. And so now they're saying, let's not worry about whether state revenue hits those targets or not. Let's just go ahead and implement these tax cuts anyway. And so it's really risky because it could cost the state hundreds of millions of dollars. And Pat Grassley, who is the House Speaker now, but he was the House Appropriations Committee Chair when this stuff was going through in 2018, and he's been a little hesitant to do anything about the triggers. I think he's a little bit worried about whether we're going to be able to pay for it. And then another wrinkle there is that this COVID relief bill, when it was going through the U.S. Senate, they threw in a new provision that says that states can't use that money to cover the cost of tax cuts. So this is the U.S. Treasury Department is going to put out guidance on how they're interpreting this. So it's a lot of it is up in the air still. But the legislature, they may be constrained if they pass any new tax cuts. They may have to turn down $2.5 billion from the federal government, which they probably don't want to do for the state of Iowa.
You just mentioned the name Grassley. We're going to talk about Pat's grandfather in just a moment. But before we get to him, just today, a few hours ago, Republican lawmakers on the State Senate Ways and Means Committee did not advance a bill that critics said would have raised taxes on Iowa's private forest land. What's that all about?
Well, this is something that the idea has been bounced around before. Right now, there is a something called the Forest Preserve Program that you can put land in that, and it will be taxed at a much lower rate than normal residential or commercial property. And the concept behind this bill was to say that to have land in the Forest Preserve Program, it would have to be at least 10 acres. Well, there are a lot of people in Iowa who have perhaps 1 or 2 acres or 5 acres of wooded land, and they would then have to pay the full property tax bill on that. And the opponents of that, one of the biggest critics was Senator Rob Hogue from Cedar Rapids, because this derecho that came in just decimated a lot of privately owned forested land in the northeastern part of the state. And he said, this is the last thing these landowners need is to then get a higher property tax bill on top of that. So that had gotten through a different Senate committee, but then it was referred to the Ways and Means Committee because it affects taxation. And today it was stopped at the subcommittee level. So that's not to say they couldn't bring it back later, but for now, that's a pretty strong signal that it doesn't have enough support to clear the chamber.
Okay. Representatives from the Ames School District were called to the State House Government Oversight Committee last week to get essentially a dressing down from Republican lawmakers, all because of what they had done during a Black Education Week, a Black Lives Education Week. Could you download that one?
This was really remarkable, honestly. I mean, the House and Senate Government Oversight Committees, they can look at almost anything. They have very broad scope. And, I mean, they could be looking at Iowans having trouble getting their unemployment payments related to the pandemic bill. They could be looking at Iowans who are on the privatized Medicaid getting their services cut, you know, things that really affect thousands of people. But instead, it seemed to me that they were really micromanaging the Ames School District, and they were drilling down at an incredibly detailed level about the curriculum materials used. And the school district representatives were trying to say, in some cases, these were things that were online, like they had posted the whole curriculum online, but that didn't mean that individual classrooms were using all parts of it. I mean, some teachers were using this and some teachers were using that, and some of it was just online and maybe not even used in anyone's classroom. But in any case, it was it was very striking to watch, honestly. I hadn't seen legislators really scold school district officials like that. And somebody representing Ames was trying to say, you know, white experiences are centered for most of the year. And so what they were trying to do with this curriculum and this program was to try to center experiences of people who are not white and who may feel marginalized. And that's the people they were particularly trying to serve. But, the Ames officials stood their ground mostly. They did say that they wish that they had given people more time to review the curriculum. I mean, they said that there were no, the legislators were concerned that parents who opted out of the curriculum would have their children would be punished or in some way. And the Ames people were saying adamantly that that hadn't happened. No one was punished. No teacher was punished for choosing not to use any particular portion of it. But they did say that next year they would try to give people a little more advanced warning to review. But I just found it amazing that that a legislative committee would spend, it was about an hour and 45 minute long meeting. It was really a long time for them to be grilling school district people over a curriculum that was used for part of 1 month.
Well, let's move on. We have about 5 minutes left. It's about 25 minutes after the hour, and we have to get into a couple of Des Moines Register polls that have come out in the last couple of days. One that was published yesterday, and this is a rather remarkable one. It shows that 55% of Iowans do not want 7-term Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley to run again for re-election. Now, among Republicans, 50% say he should run. Among Democrats, 77% say he should not. Let's talk about that. If the senator were to run, it would be his 8th term. He would be 95 years old if he, you know, survives it, lives through it. Mm-hmm. But what about this poll? Most Iowans don't want him to run.
I was struck, the most amazing number to me in that poll was that 35% of Republicans don't think he should run. And also that his overall job approval rating is only at 48%. Mm-hmm. They said that's the lowest level they'd measured for Senator Grassley since 1982. Grassley has, of course, you know, never lost an election. He was first elected to the Iowa House in 1958. He was first elected to the U.S. House in 1974 and to the U.S. Senate in 1980. And since 1980, that was a relatively close election against John Culver. He won by about 8 points. But since then, he's never been reelected with less than 60% of the vote. He wins routinely with 20 to 30 point margins. So to see that 55% thought he shouldn't run again, it really was striking. And I think it speaks to a general level of unease. I mean, he's in excellent health by, to all appearances, but I mean, to think that he's going to be able to do a very demanding job well into his 90s, you know, it is a bit of a reach for some people. Now, that's not to say that he wouldn't still be favored if he does run for an eighth term. I mean, I think he still would be very difficult to beat.
If he were not to run, and he has said he will make that decision this fall sometime.
Yes.
But if he were not to run, who would run to fill that seat? We know that State Senator Jim Carlin's already tossed his hat in the ring, not even knowing whether Senator Grassley's going to run. Who reasonably could run for that seat and be a viable contender?
I think the front runner would be Matt Whitaker. This is a former U.S. attorney who then was acting attorney general for Donald Trump briefly after the 2018 election. I think that it's very possible he could get Donald Trump's endorsement, and he would be a difficult candidate to beat in a GOP primary, honestly, I believe. And he's doing the rounds. He's going to be this spring. He's going to be the headliner at the Johnson County Republican Party dinner. He's been doing other GOP events. So I think he'll be ready to jump right in. I don't think he'll challenge Chuck Grassley, but I think if Grassley retires, Matt Whitaker will be in. I think I would imagine a few other people would run as well, but that's who I would guess would be the odds-on favorite to be the GOP nominee.
If Matt Whitaker becomes the nominee, and again, this assumes, and we should not assume, that the senator will not run, if he becomes the nominee, do the Democrats have a prayer of defeating Matt Whitaker?
You know, I think in an open seat race, who knows? I mean, the midterm election generally favors the party out of power, which would be the Republican Party. So I think it would be a really uphill. But of course, they'd have a better chance against Matt Whitaker than they would against someone like Chuck Grassley, certainly. And there are no Democratic candidates declared. I know there are people trying to convince former retired Admiral Mike Franken to run. He was the runner-up in the 2020 Democratic Senate primary. So I think that he's probably considering it. But, you know, I think that with Matt Whitaker, I mean, there's a lot that he was involved in the Justice Department that might not look great, you know, under scrutiny during a general election campaign. So we would have to see.
I have a couple of minutes left. Another new Register poll, one published today, shows that most Iowans, pardon me, hold favorable views of President Biden. Now, this in spite of the states having voted to reelect former President Trump by 8 percentage points. What do you make of this?
Well, remember that when the Register polls people on favorability and job approval, they're asking all Iowa adults, not Iowa registered voters or people who voted in the 2020 election. So Joe Biden's favorable numbers, I mean, people generally support his approach to the COVID-19 pandemic, and I think that's a factor here. But he's in a little bit of a honeymoon period. I mean, they said the last time they pulled his favorability in September, it was at 43%. Now it's at 51%. And his job approval rating at 47% is actually higher than Donald Trump's was for most of the Trump presidency, even though Trump carried the state of Iowa comfortably twice in a row. So again, the favorability numbers among all Iowa adults is different from people who actually vote in elections.
And very briefly, you wrote this past weekend on your blog site that state Republican leaders apparently do not want to wait for accurate census information before redistricting takes place.
Yes, well, they're upset because if the Census Bureau doesn't give out the data until the end of September, then the process is going to be controlled by the Iowa Supreme Court, and they're talking about possibly suing the federal government to get that data. I just don't think that that's going to be successful, even if they go that route, because the Census Bureau just isn't ready to give them the data.
All right. What do you see coming up in the legislature this week?
Well, the Iowa House, just moments before we went on the air, passed a bill that would allow housing discrimination, or rather it would ban local ordinances that oppose housing discrimination. And I think the Senate may take that up very soon.
And do you think that's going to pass the Senate?
I think it will. I mean, it's similar to other things that they've passed in recent years that limit local government's ability to regulate things. And it's something that landlords want. And so I think that one probably will end up on the governor's desk. So we'll probably have to talk about that more in a future week.
And let's plan on it. We're done for tonight. Laura, thank you.
Thank you, Dennis.
We are just about out of time for tonight. You've been listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. Laura Belling and I will be right back here next Monday night, 7 o'clock, straight up, with a look at what makes news in the Iowa State Legislature this week and what it means for all of us. Until then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time, and good night.